Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. This is Cliff. It is September the 6th. Wow, we're already in the September. I hope you're having a good day. It is overcast here in Oakland, California, but usually sun breaks out within a few hours, so I'm looking for a good day. A lot of people ask me what my interest is and why I have launched this podcast and continue to populate a very popular website, the Facebook page. And I'd say for probably the better part of 25 years, I've felt that our history was filtered or edited in a certain way by the various factions that produce our history, anthropologists, archaeologists, and the various subgroups that supply them with information. And it really was driven home when I took my first visit to Mexico and was introduced to the ruins of the Yucatan Peninsula. I was taken on a couple of private tours by a couple of natives, most notably the Mayan elder Humboldt's men. And I was dumbfounded. I was so shocked at the sophisticated construction, engineering, and I repeated every time almost to a chorus that the Maya were very sophisticated people, much more so than we've been led to believe. And yet they're portrayed as loincloth-wearing savages who were bloodthirsty and, practice cannibalism and other blood rituals throughout their history. Well, that's just not true. It can't be true. And unfortunately, we don't know the specifics of how they evolved, because the Spanish burned all their documents. They burned their history, their codices. But the huge buildings and their pyramids are all technological wonders. They're engineering wonders. And they must have had a period in their history where they were engineers and mathematicians, and we already know about their their astronomy, their medicine and mathematics, but they at a period must have devolved, and what we are left with and what the Spanish chronicled were the last remains of a once proud people. So, but anyhow, that's just one edited history that we have according to Orthodox science, that the Mayan people were these savages. To a culture, the Chinese, the India, Central and South America, all have evidence of very, very sophisticated people, advanced. In some cases, using forms of electricity, understanding the natural currents of the earth. There's so much that has come to light that is not presented in mainstream history. And so my interest is to expose these bits of information as they come to light and reveal them in as many ways as I can. And so here we have a podcast, Earth Ancient Radio, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. And, you know, I'm presenting to you the authorities on the other points of view, people who have, in some cases, spent their life researching and investigating unknown cultures from our past. So that is my interest, that is my devotion to this material in these websites. So that being said, I think it's interesting to note that President Obama spent some of his time while he was in the UK yesterday at Stonehenge, and this is significant. I've posted on the Facebook page President Obama's visit to Stonehenge. And it's significant for a number of reasons. First of all, when an American president goes anywhere, it is literally a huge undertaking, not only for the hundreds of people who have to prepare his way and the security teams that have to prepare the area he's visiting, but for President Obama to choose the Stonehenge to visit is a significant statement by him. He actually even said that the place was spectacular and that it was on his bucket list. And the photograph I posted and the links actually show him. He had, by the way, he had a private tour of Stonehenge. And you can see him walking through them. He most of Stonehenge is off limits to the general public, but he was given access to walk right up to these the megaliths and touch them and be a part of them. He made a statement I thought was profound, and he said the place Stonehenge had a very unusual feel to it. So that has to make you wonder now, is the president of the United States sensitive to energies of emissions from the ground, from the Stonehenge, or is he just saying that as just kind of a off-the-wall statement? It makes you wonder. But anyhow, take a look at the president and read the article, and you can see him walking through Stonehenge. I think it's a significant statement about not only his interest, but the interest of our culture as a whole in ancient established megaliths and the people who may have built them. So have a look at that. The other thing I want to mention before we go to our guest is I was sent a amazing video of San Martin, Peru, and what appears to be a man-made water system, some kind of a water system. And I followed it up with some photographs of the actual megalithic rock system that was built to carry water from a high point of a river down to a lower holding tank. And then it was sluiced down to be used in some other unknown manner. And it's a fascinating, massive stone structure. And these kind of discoveries are becoming more prevalent technology makes their appearance more available. These camcorders and cameras are recording amazing, amazing ruins from the past. So take a look at that, and you know, let me know what you think. Email me, post to Facebook. I think what did I call it here? It's called Ancient Man-Made Water Systems at San Martin, Peru, Part 1 and Part 2. Fascinating, massive, massive stone undertaking. In fact, the first part of the video shows an explorer. He's got a machete in his hand, and he's actually showing the precision cuts of the stonework that is made up of the walkway that appears to the left side of a man-made water system. And no one really knows how old it is or the culture who built it, but it must have fed quite a large group of people because it's a monstrous thing. So today I'm really I'm quite happy and pleased that Andrew Collins has joined me. And Andrew's a unique individual. He's been investigating since 1979 the idea of an advanced civilization existing before recorded history. And he's been actually one of the only investigators that I know who's focused on southeastern Turkey since the 1990s. And he also uncovered some interesting caves in Egypt at the Giza Plateau, which have now been, I think the name of them is Collins Caves. And he wrote an interesting book on them that kind of opened up a lot of people's eyes to what may have been an underground water system that are now caves. He's the author of From the Ashes of Angels, Gods of Eden, and Gateway to Atlantis. And he was nice enough to give me some time between trips, and we did a short interview, and I'm going to play it here in a minute. But the important thing to know about Göbekli Tepe is it's one of the most sophisticated structures in the world, and it dates to 12,000 BC. And they keep finding more of these T-shaped megaliths around the area that he's going to describe. It's really quite a unique place. So here's the interview. And just to remind you, I will be posting some photographs that he has sent to me on this new book. The book's called Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, The Temple of the Watchers and the Discovery of Eden by Andrew Collins. And here's the interview. Welcome, Andrew Collins, to Earth Ancients. I'm glad to have you on the program.
Good day to you, Cliff. Here it's in the evening, and for you it's probably the morning.
Exactly. It's 10:54 here in Oakland AM. What time is it in England right now?
Just come out 7 o'clock.
Just 7 o'clock. Perfect. You have written a great deal about unknown ancient civilizations for years. Your books were widely known and have been well received. What piqued your interest in Turkey and specifically the ruins of Göbekli Tepe?
Well, my interest in southeast Anatolia, which is what the landmass is called, obviously Turkey is the republic there today, is that in the 1990s, I was looking at the origins of civilization. I was focusing my attention primarily on ancient Egypt and trying to understand probably the age of the Sphinx and things like this. And I began to conclude at that time that there'd been a cataclysm probably around 9,000, 10,000 BC that seemed to be recorded in myth and legend, and that there were stories about the inhabitants of Egypt escaping this cataclysm, which was put down to the wrath of, the wrath of this sun god Ra. An act carried out, it was said, by the lioness-headed goddess Sekhmet, who rained down fire upon the earth before she was stopped by the god Ra placing this flood around her of beer, of all things, and she drank this beer, fell asleep, and forgot her duty. That's the story in ancient Egypt. But what it did say is that the people of ancient Egypt either hid in holes or, you know, disappeared into some other part of the ancient world. And there were a number of other accounts that suggested this as well, that they may have escaped this cataclysm by moving somewhere else. And my focus started to fall on the area of the Euphrates River. Which obviously takes its rise in eastern Turkey or Anatolia and then flows down through Syria and Iraq and obviously empties out into the Gulf of Persia. And I began to realise that this was the cradle of civilization, the place where the so-called Neolithic revolution in agriculture and animal domestication and metallurgy and astronomy and built structures and things like this all began around 9000 BC in the area of southeast Anatolia. And I looked at this and I also started to connect with it the myths and legends of the Watchers, these human angels without wings, mm-hmm. mentioned in the Book of Enoch, which is an ancient Hebrew text that goes back at least 200 to 300 BC and was found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947. And it talks about these tall, strange-looking beings with long viper-like faces and pale skin and pale hair, giving humanity this knowledge and wisdom which was amounted to the secrets of heaven, and they shouldn't have done this. It was also said that they took mortal wives who produced these giant offspring called Nephilim. And also there were parallel legends in Sumeria of the so-called Anunnaki gods, the gods of heaven and earth, that were also said to have given humanity not just the rudiments of civilization and how to dig irrigation channels, but also it was said that they gave humanity the first grain and sheep. Now, the first sheep obviously is a reference to animal husbandry, which took place in this very area about 9000 BC onwards, and not just sheep, obviously goats, cattle, and pigs, but and the grain is obviously a reference to agriculture, the introduction of domesticated wheat and rye and barley. So basically we were talking about the same thing, you know, the Watchers, the Anunnaki seem to be a memory of the prime movers, possibly even the shamans, as there are descriptions of them wearing cloaks of feathers, that had been behind the Neolithic revolution, whatever had gone on in southeast Turkey around 9000 BC. Mm-hmm. And that all of this had happened roughly around the time of some kind of cataclysm. And this was the main premise of the book From the Ashes of Angels, which I wrote in 1996, which was a bestseller around the world. And also 2 years later, I brought out a book called Gods of Eden, which also followed on these ideas. And it also started looking at even deeper some of the technology and the engineering of this early, almost like proto-Neolithic culture that seemed to exist in southeast Anatolia, who were constructing these strange pillars with anthropomorphic features and creating the first temple structures and stuff like this. But this was all before I knew anything about Göbekli Tepe. All this was around 1998.
Oh, okay.
And then in the year 2000, it was announced the discovery of Göbekli Tepe itself. And this basically changed everything, mm-hmm. because here you didn't just have an odd little building that had been constructed. Here you had this vast complex of the earliest stone circles anywhere in the world, made up of series of stones. The biggest of the structures were 12 stones, you know, which is obviously a very cosmic number. And in the middle of them were these massive great monoliths up to 18 and a half feet, which is 5.5 meters in height, mm-hmm. and weighing as much as 15 and 20 tons apiece. Many of the stones had beautiful carvings of animals and insects and other creatures of the natural world upon them, birds.
Okay.
And other of the stones were quite clearly anthropomorphic. They were human-like in appearance, with arms and hands, even evidence of waistcoats or some kind of garment that they were wearing, but also belts that even had belt buckles on them that were of a sophisticated nature, with ideograms and glyphs actually on the belts, mm-hmm. suggesting that you're dealing with some kind of extremely high culture that might even be comparable with the Maya of Central America as far as their development was concerned.
Let me ask you,
changed everything.
Let me ask you, when Klaus Schmidt was out there, did he just go by the Turkish farmer reference, or was there other people who had gone out there and found pot shards? Because as I read the information, the sheep herder found shards and found just the tips of these monoliths poking out of the ground. What year did Schmidt start excavating that area? And what was his desire? And I guess he was funded by his own countrymen. But tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, look, here's the timeline. The first person that's known to have gone to Göbekli Tepe was a guy by the name of Peter Benedict in 1963. Mm. And he went with a small survey team that were looking at all of the so-called tepes or huyaks of the area, which are like artificial mounds, mounds of occupation that are like little bumps on the landscape. You find them frequently in this region of the world. And they're evidence of activity either in the Bronze Age generally or earlier into the Neolithic Age. And he looked at various of these, and he went to Göbekli Tepe and he found evidence of stone fragments that had carving on. Mm-hmm. Yes, he did notice various stone tools and things like that around. He never found any pottery shards whatsoever, because it was quite clear that, from later studies, that we're dealing with a culture that existed before the actual manufacture of ceramics.
Okay.
But here's the weird one. He actually put down Göbekli Tepe as evidence of a medieval Byzantine cemetery, i.e. a Christian cemetery, anything from, let's say, 300 to medieval times in origin. Hmm. And the reason why he did that is because the carving was so sophisticated, the small fragments he found, that he could not bring himself to connect this with the Neolithic Age.
Okay.
And remember, this was 1963, before excavations in this area. So, okay, that's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened is that during the 1980s, the farmer that tilled the land kept coming across stone fragments, and obviously he was aware too of the stone tools that were in the area, and he would put them on the walls of the edge of the fields, and occasionally he would feel moved to go to the local museum at in the city of Urfa or Schönlurfa, which is only about 8 miles away from here. This is a mountaintop area, mm-hmm. quite rugged. And to show evidence of this to the museum, who, in all honesty, did not seem to take any interest whatsoever, whether it was because of the low standing that they considered this farmer, or they just didn't have staff to do anything. And the staff never, ever followed this up. They never went to the hill to have a look.
Wow.
And it wasn't until 1994, I think the month was October, that Professor Klaus Schmidt, a very forward-thinking German archaeologist who previously worked on another, what they call a pre-pottery Neolithic site at a place called Nivali Chori in the extreme north of the Shanlurfa province. So he knew roughly what he was looking at. I mean, I already knew about Nivali Chori as well, I'd mentioned it in Gods of Eden. So he'd done the excavations, all the rest of it. So when he finally arrived at Göbekli Tepe in 1994, he recognized immediately what there was here. And, you know, he knew that somewhere beneath this artificial mound was evidence of a very, very early Neolithic sanctuary. I think he realized that right from the word go. And that these stone fragments were fragments from T-shaped pillars like had been found at Nivali Chori. And by the way, Nivali Chori is slightly later. The dates for that were probably something like about 8,000-8,500 BC. Whereas it became apparent that Göbekli Tepe was older, certainly had been founded much earlier, probably as early as 9,500 BC.
Okay.
And that the monuments here were much more sophisticated, older and much more sophisticated, which is really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And the activity had gone on here for a period of around 1,500 years, from about 9,500 to about 8,000 BC, all before the invention of ceramics, but at the very time when the Neolithic Revolution starts.
Okay.
So, in other words, the first people that arrived at Göbekli Tepe were hunter-gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is that they were the local population, and their main occupation in life was just providing for their family and their immediate social group, you know, enough food and enough hides and enough, you know, oil and from the game that they would catch, and that's it. That's what their life revolved around.
Mm-hmm.
But something big changed everything, and it's trying to understand what went on at this time, why Göbekli Tepe was constructed,
mm-hmm.
and by whom? Who was behind this?
So,
and for what reason it was constructed? That's the bigger questions that we need to be asking here.
So, as Schmidt was digging down and unveiling these large monoliths, he must have been in shock. And I'm curious, these T-shaped monoliths are in excess of 10 to 15 tons, which is, that's a significant weight.
You're absolutely.
What have you discovered about these monoliths that is unique in the carvings? Because we spoke with Robert Schock, who feels that the carved figures and animals are very refined and highly designed from some group that's completely unknown. What did you discover about the monoliths?
Well, I think that he's basically correct. I mean, the refineness, the finishing, and the engineering skill involved in the creation of the monoliths and their carvings is something that is unique to the ancient world during the 10th millennium BC. I mean, in theory, we don't know of anywhere else in the world where this was taking place. I mean, there are other sites which have been suggested to go back as early as this. And we're talking the Great Sphinx in Egypt. We're talking Tiwanaku and Pumapunka in Bolivia, which has got incredible engineering and stories about cataclysms and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got this new site that's come up called Gunung Padang in Indonesia, which is essentially a pyramidical hill with a megalithic structure on the top of it, which goes back certainly several thousand years, and recent redating evidence suggests that it could even go back to 20,000 BC, but that's very, very controversial. Now, all of these are sites worth watching, but the problem with all of them is that there's no absolute confirmation that the sites go back to the time of the last ice age. Whereas at Göbekli Tepe, the archaeologists are in no doubt. They have radiocarbon dating evidence. They have contextual dating evidence through the discovery of different types of stone tools that can be compared with others found at other sites from contemporary age. So there is absolutely no question about what's going on at Göbekli Tepe. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it so unique and so important, because it almost becomes a smoking gun of a lost civilization.
Right.
You know, because, you know, you've got to say to yourself, who was doing this sort of thing in the 10th millennium? And you have to look around, and there was only a few people doing that. But I found who was doing that prior to this time. And that was a culture known as the Solutrians. The Solutrians were a population that existed in mostly in Western Europe, but also in Central Europe. And they would seem to have been the painters of some of the earliest cave art inside, obviously, the caves of Spain and France.
Mm-hmm.
But they also were creating these rock panels, which, in other words, they were getting big stones, flattening them down, and creating these high reliefs of animals and humans, and some of them with very symbolic features, you know, to do with cosmology. And they were placing them in horseshoe shapes within cave environments as friezes that would obviously aid, presumably, the hunting magic and the astral magic and whatever else that they were doing in there. So these, as far as I'm concerned, this is the earliest confirmed use of stone panels to create this type of rock art. And this dates back to anything to around 18 to 20,000 BC.
Okay.
And this, again, this is not something that's in dispute.
Right.
And what I found is that there's evidence that their, not survivors, probably not the right word, but their descendants, connected with them, who were kicking around in the millennia before the construction of Göbekli Tepe, and they're known as the Swiderians. They were mostly based in the area from central into eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
with main centres in the Carpathian Mountains, Poland, what we now know as the Ukraine, obviously, and the area of Russia. And what's happened is that around 10,900 BC, there would seem to have been a comet impact event that triggered a number of different things, including wildfires and, you know, a whole period of rain, a period of darkness, and also a mini ice age that lasted for about 1,300 years, known as the Younger Dryas event. In fact,
right.
this comet impact is known to science today as the Younger Dryas, it was the Younger Dryas impact.
Event
or sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Anyway, it's got that word in it.
Right.
Younger Dryas. And the important thing about this is that this wasn't an event that just lasted one single day. There's evidence that there were repercussions for several hundred years after the initial impact, some of which may have been further impacts. In other words, this was a terrible time to live. You know, there were bad things going on in the world, wildfires, and evidence of this has been found not only on the American continent, which would seem to have been the worst hit, but also in Europe, in Egypt, in parts of Russia, you know, further east, and even as far away as Australia.
Right.
And it's been found within 100 miles of Göbekli Tepe itself.
Okay.
And this is very, very important, because there's a visionary writer by the name of Barbara Han Clough. She's written various books, and in, I think it was 2001, she wrote a book called Catastrophobia.
Yes.
And it was all about the state of mind of people after a major cataclysm involving a comet, which quite clearly is the one that we're all talking about now.
Right.
And what she basically suggested was that people would have been in fear that these catastrophes would continue to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she was absolutely bang on the nail with this.
Yes.
That by the time that you came to Göbekli Tepe, which was constructed just after the end of this 1,300-year mini ice age, that the people were still suffering catastrophobia. They still feared that these cataclysms would occur every time a comet appeared in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that coming into this region at this very time were a people with a very special stone technology. The descendants of these Seleucians, who were also astronomers, very powerful shamans, had a very intricate culture, a very advanced nature, who the archaeologists refer to as the Swiderians, and that they came in to the area of southeast Anatolia, and I think that they were much more sophisticated than the local population, and they basically took over the control of this area and said, look, we can tell you how to stop your catastrophobia if you listen to us and do what we say. And what they said was construct these monuments, which we know today as Göbekli Tepe, and also others that came after it, like Nivali Chori and others as well. Mm-hmm. And this was the first supersizing of these monuments. And why did they want to build them? They wanted to build them almost as like portals, gateways, stargates, if you like, that would allow the shaman access to the other world on the quick. And why would they need that access? Because every time a comet came into the sky, or some other event occurred, which they believed was like the precursor for another cataclysm, the shamans could enter the other world through altered states of consciousness and deal with the supernatural forces, the supernatural creatures that they believed were responsible for these type of cataclysms. And all the indications are that they were seen in the form of a sky fox or a sky wolf, some kind of supernatural canid, you know, dog-like creature, that brought devastation to the world, had the ability to quite literally end the world or end time itself by collapsing the pole that held up the heavens. And we know this from shamanic traditions across the Eurasian continent and also in Africa, that talk about these so-called cosmic tricksters that exist out there just to cause problems for the world and the human race. And it was the job of the shaman to go into this world to try and deal with these problems. And the best example of one of these cosmic tricksters in this form is in Norse mythology, where you have the traditions of what's known as Ragnarok. It's a word that means the twilight or doom of the gods. A huge, great devastation, which seems to be a reflection of something that happened in the past but could also happen again, where even the gods died, and humanity was virtually wiped out. There was that the earth was almost turned upside down in, let's say, earthquakes and other violent activity. But there was also a flood, it would seem, and also a mini ice age. Again, it's exactly what Ragnarok tells us. And I think this is a direct memory of this Younger Dryas comet impact event. And that it was remembered and carried all the way down through the millennia, virtually to our current, you know, age, basically.
Okay. Now, has there been a report on Göbekli Tepe that they feel that the central civic center area was an observatory for observation? I haven't heard that yet. Is that something that
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, both, you know, Dr. Robert Schock and myself have both talked about the fact that the largest enclosures there may be aligned to the stars. Now, we have differing opinions on which direction they're looking, but in my opinion, there is incredible evidence that they're looking towards the north, towards the polar region, and the stars that revolve around what we know as the celestial pole. Now, there was no pole star in that age. There was just a sort of dark area in the middle of the stars revolving around. But what's clear is that in the north-northwest section of the wall, the circular walls of the two largest enclosures, which are known as Enclosure C and Enclosure D, there's a flat standing stone, with a hole all the way through it. It's about 12 inches, about a foot across, and a person, they're all, and it's perfectly in line with the azimuth, the mean azimuth, the orientation of the big twin monoliths in these two particular enclosures.
Okay.
And what this means is a shaman or somebody entering inside that enclosure and standing between these twin monoliths would able to have been able to look through these circular porthole stones and see the local horizon and witness a very specific event taking place every night. And this was the setting of a bright star known as Deneb. And this is the brightest star in a constellation called Cygnus, the celestial swan.
Mm-hmm.
And what this star marks is a point on the Milky Way where the Milky Way splits in two into two separate streams, which are known as the Great Rift, or the Cygnus Rift, as it's known at this particular position. And what I show in various books is that this was seen as the point of entry into a sky world, like an upper world, an otherworldly environment, where it was seen that humanity emerged from at the beginning of time, i.e. the earliest souls, if you like, but also where our souls go back to at the time of death. And that, you know, this was where what the Christians would refer to as heaven was located.
Okay.
In the, you know, in the northern polar region. And that all the orientations at Göbekli Tepe and other sites, including Göbekli Tepe's sister site, Karahan Tepe, which has not even been excavated yet. I'm just finishing an article on that now, showing that that's also orientated towards Deneb and the Milky Way's Great Rift.
Okay.
And why was this important? Because it was seen as the place of emergence. It was seen as the original spot that life came from originally and would return to in death. And therefore, this was the portal, the gateway that the shaman had to go within to get back to the place of beginning, the place of creation, if you like,
mm-hmm.
which is where not only the ancestors were, you know, your own family, but also the celestial beings that created the universe and all of these other supernatural creatures that were seen to inhabit the other world, like these sky foxes and sky wolves and things like that,
mm-hmm.
that could be dealt with on a supernatural or a shamanic level.
Okay.
And so that's the reason why they are observatories.
Okay.
And there is a lot of carving and imagery within the stones that seems to back up this.
Okay.
You know, so it seems pretty certain that these were astronomically aligned, these enclosures.
Okay. Let's talk about the people who constructed these. You say it's your estimation that another group of people came into that area of Turkey that you call the Watchers. And you've described a little bit about them, but they appear to be have originated from a very sophisticated civilization to be able to build those monoliths and also construct them in such a way to be able to use them as observatories. What can you tell us about them? And has there been any excavations of skeletal remains in or around Göbekli Tepe that hasn't been posted? Because I'd be very curious to know if they have unearthed a complete skeleton.
Okay, well, last question answered first, and that's, yes, they have found evidence of skeletal remains within not only the fill that was used to cover up the different enclosures periodically, I think at the end of their useful lives, almost to kill them, you know, like you would do, you know, breaking off an arrowhead or something like that and breaking it at the end of its life to release the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to have happened. They found human remains in that, but also they found skeletal remains within the wall of some of the enclosures, not the big old ones as far as I'm aware, mm-hmm. but in one of the lesser ones that abuts the bigger ones, which
okay.
is enclosure B. And they have radiocarbon dated those, and they, you know, the end result of it is that it is possible that these are intrusions from a slightly later period, i.e. not when the actual monuments were constructed around 9,500 BC, but possibly as late as 8,000 BC, mm-hmm. you know, right at the tail end. So a lot of things could have happened during that time. But so, and as to, and yeah, you're right, nothing has been posted, nothing has been published so far that tells us about the people behind the manufacture of Göbekli Tepe. And even if we do get some evidence of what those skeletons look like, we don't know who they were. We don't know whether they were the local population, or we don't know whether they were the elite. Mm-hmm. Because I'm pretty certain, just like in places like Mexico with amongst the Maya, or amongst the different cultures of Peru, for instance, where you find that there is an elite, a ruling elite, mm-hmm. that, you know, control the show, and that the local population just go along with what's going on. I think that there was something like that occurring at Göbekli Tepe. Otherwise, I am pretty certain none of this would have actually been created, because suggestions by some archaeologists that the people, you know, got together in some kind of, you know, spirit of communal, you know, activity, just to sort of create some kind of, you know, prehistoric church where they could all go in and, you know, and venerate the gods for giving them the harvest, and that. It's almost crap, to be honest. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to place the same mindset of a Christian over the last 1500 years, mm-hmm. on that of peoples that were hunter gatherers. Remember, these people had no need to come together. They worked together in small groups of probably 15 and 20. They never really had permanent residence. They would have had temporary accommodation that they would probably go to for a few months a year before moving on to follow the herds, which they were particularly interested in. And that's it. That's their life. It was a great life back then. You know what I mean? You could do what you like.
Yeah.
So why would they all suddenly stop that, gather together in their thousands to create Göbekli Tepe? It doesn't make any sense, unless something big had occurred. And I think that big is your cataclysm and the catastrophobia that resulted from the fear, mm-hmm. of cataclysms taking place. Okay. Fear is the thing that makes a lot of things happen. At the times of war, more inventions are generally made at times of war, because people, through necessity, you know, and fear that they're about to be wiped out, will advance in staggeringly fast pace, you know, as was obviously witnessed at the time of the Second World War with the atomic bomb and whatever.
Right.
You know, we move forward at a great pace. And I think that's exactly what happened at Göbekli Tepe.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about this elite at Göbekli Tepe.
Yes.
All the evidence is that they were human hybrids. They were extremely tall. They had elongated heads. They had long faces, just like the watchers are described, like vipers. They possibly had quite thick eyebrows, and quite long jaws. Why did they look like this? Why did they look so strange? Because they were a hybrid, not of aliens or anything like that, but of two different types of humans. One of them is our own, you know, forebears, the Homo sapiens, who were generally referred to as Cro-Magnon when they first entered into the European scene. And the others were our distant cousins, the Neanderthals. The Neanderthals have generally been put down as brutish, ugly, you know, thick, mm-hmm. unintelligent. But we now know that that's absolutely not the case. In fact, we now know that Neanderthals were probably just as intelligent as us, and may even have given us a lot of the rudiments, not so much of a civilization, which is a very material thing, which I think probably comes from our Cro-Magnon background, but specifically the more ritual, the more spiritual, the more dream-like existence, which almost certainly came from the our Neanderthal distant cousins. And although I've worked this out, I can't take full credit for it, because in the as early as the 1970s, a writer by the name of Stan Gooch wrote a first book about the Neanderthal question, and he basically predicted that modern humans were a result of hybridization between these two different types of humans, and I think that he was absolutely correct. And that the Watchers are essentially human hybrids, much more hybrid than we are today, and they had the rationalization of our own Homo sapien ancestors, but also the dream, the ritual, the shamanic background, you know, the worship or veneration of things like the moon and the stars and the rest of it seems to come from a much more dreamy background that's more associated with the Neanderthals than the hard survival rationalization of the Cro-Magnon Homo sapien population. Mm-hmm. But bring those two together and you've got a different creature altogether, one who moves forward very, very quickly and is very, very clever, very, very intelligent, and can apply all these ideas, including astronomy and shamanism and technological skills, you know, that of art and crafts and culture,
mm-hmm.
and bring all that to bear to create what we now know as Göbekli Tepe. But I don't think that Göbekli Tepe was created in isolation. I think that eventually we will find other Göbekli Tepes in other parts of the world. Maybe we've already found them.
Okay.
You know, perhaps it is the Sphinx. Perhaps it is Gudum Budang in Java. Perhaps it is Puma Punka in South America.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's a possibility. But what I do know is that all of this was as a response to a terrible event that had occurred in the world. But the next important thing, of course, is impact. And
right.
that is in the myths and legends that come after all of these events that mix everything up. The cataclysm, these strange-looking people, you know, these human hybrids, the Swiderians and earlier who were related to the Salutrians much earlier, who also were hybrids as well. You know, what's the impact? Well, the impact in Hebrew tradition goes through into the Book of Enoch with the idea of the Watchers of who were said to have existed in paradise or in Eden or in heaven, and to have descended down amongst mortal kind and to have given us the arts and sciences of heaven, the forbidden arts and sciences of heaven. In other words, they weren't supposed to tell us because they were an elite, and that obviously others of their group said, no, you can't tell the local population about metallurgy and about the stars and about, you know, this. And obviously they said, no, we're going to break away, we're going to do our own thing, we're going to live with these local population, you know, and give them some of our ideas. And for that reason, they were persecuted.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with the Anunnaki. I think the Anunnaki are memory of the Swiderian peoples, these human hybrids that came into Southeast Anatolia, modern-day Turkey. And that also we have to talk about the Garden of Eden, because the Garden of Eden is, well, let's say Göbekli Tepe is basically on the edge of the land of Eden. I mean, even Professor Klaus Schmidt, you know, rest in peace, he died only a month ago. Even linked the idea of the Garden of Eden with Göbekli Tepe in 2007.
Right.
So how does all that relate? Because this is Judeo-Christian,
right.
you know, Muslim tradition about, you know, the Garden of Eden and about Adam and Eve. How does that fit into the picture? Well, I think it's this. And that's it, that if you want to look for a geographical location of Eden, you have to follow what the book of Genesis tells us. And that says that it's where the four rivers of paradise take their rise. Two of those rivers are easily identified as the Euphrates, and the other being the Tigris. Both of those rise in eastern Turkey, you know, Anatolia.
Mm-hmm.
The other two, slightly more debatable, but they also rise in eastern Turkey. Now, that's only about 150, maximum 200 miles away from Göbekli Tepe here. So that's really important. The other important things are that all of the early events in the book of Genesis, like Noah's Ark coming to rest on a mountain within about 150 miles away from Göbekli Tepe. Is that a coincidence? No, it's not. Mm-hmm. And all of the early events of the book of Genesis, right up to and including the life of Abraham, the patriarch, who eventually is born in a place called Ur of the Chaldees, which is traditionally the city of Urfa or Shanli Urfa, 8 miles away from Göbekli Tepe, spends some time at a place called Haran, this ancient city on the Haran Plains, immediately beneath Göbekli Tepe, and then leaves there at God's command to go into the Promised Land, which is Canaan, and this is the foundation point, of course, of the Israelite race.
Mm-hmm.
So he brings all these traditions, which had obviously built up all these myths and legends, probably including the stories of the Watchers and the Nephilim. He brings those into what was then Canaan, that becomes Israel, that we, today we know as Palestine, as obviously the modern state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we associate a lot of the Genesis stories and Eden and the rest of it with the area around Jerusalem and that. But that wasn't its original place of foundation. It was much further north in the area that we now know as southeast Turkey. That's where it all began. That's where all of these stories and tales began. And that's why we associate them. But what then was the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden? Well, remember, they were there living in bliss. They had immortality, they didn't need to work, they didn't need to do anything, and then suddenly the serpent, who quite possibly is one of these watchers, I mean the Book of Enoch even tells us that it was one of the watchers in the form of a serpent that tempted Eve, gives the forbidden fruit to Adam and Eve, they take it, they suddenly lose their innocence, lose their purity, and realize suddenly that they're naked, as if suddenly they'd never been aware that they were naked before. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a bigger story going on here.
Yeah.
And what happens? They get thrown out of the Garden of Eden, and God says to them, forever you must now till the land. What does tilling the land actually mean? It means agriculture, you know, becoming farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And we all think of the forbidden fruit as this nice, beautiful, rosy red apple. But of course, that's not what the book of Genesis tells us at all. In fact, it doesn't actually tell us what this forbidden fruit was. And I found ancient accounts that say that forbidden fruit was wheat, you know, an ear of wheat. Now, that's incredible, because what it's suggesting is that as soon as we hit the Neolithic Revolution and agriculture began, the Golden Age stopped. We were, you know, in other words, our place in this beautiful Garden of Eden, which you can see almost as the Golden Age that existed up until this time,
mm-hmm.
was lost. And suddenly, forever afterwards, we're tilling the land. We're forced into this lifestyle where we're now living in communities of hundreds, if not thousands of people, all with one common goal, to produce agriculture, to feed everybody, including the masons, the architects, the stone carvers, you know, the people working in the quarries, the quarrymen, the pilgrims that would come to places like Göbekli Tepe by the thousands, and would set up probably at its base, becoming almost like a sort of Glastonbury of its age. You know, suddenly our lives have changed. No longer do we have this beautiful free lifestyle of being hunter-gatherers, where we can do what we like every day. All we need to do is, you know, provide for our family and, you know, and have a laugh with our local social group. Now, we are told to get up at a certain time. We're told we have taskmasters who tell us what to do. We're told what time to go to sleep.
Yeah.
It's the beginning of the end for freedom, and it's the sort of thing which we're still complaining about today with corporations and, you know, sticking it to the man and everything.
Yeah.
It's still with us today. It started 9,000 BC. That was the beginning of the current cycle, and we're still in it now.
Interesting. I want to go back a little bit because you go into quite a bit of detail regarding the Watchers, and but what I want you to talk a little bit about is where you theorize they may have come from. If this cataclysm was at such a level that it destroyed high level, very advanced civilizations like an Atlantis or like a I don't know, wherever the high-level civilizations would be, are you suggesting that the Watchers were from these places and then settled in the area of Göbekli Tepe and basically had to start from scratch because they didn't have the machines to carve exact stones anymore? They had to do it by hand. But the level of craftsmanship is very, very refined.
Well, I don't believe that there was any Plato or Edgar Casey style Atlantis with, you know, crystal wands and, you know, great mansions and temples existing prior to this cataclysm. I really don't think that that was there. I mean, I could be wrong, and I hope to be proved wrong. Mm-hmm. But what I do believe existed was what Stan Gusch referred to as City of Dreams, basically. In other words, there were very, very advanced cultures who were very advanced on a spiritual nature, but they also had things like you know, long houses, they had astronomy, they had very advanced forms of stone technology, you know, that they created stone friezes, and this they had as early as 30,000 BC. And at that time, it's a fact that in central Russia, they had agriculture, or certainly they were at least experimenting with agriculture, and that so therefore you've got 20,000 years of advance and evolution before you get to Göbekli Tepe. So when you get these Swiderian peoples that are coming in from what we would call the Eastern European Plain, which is essentially Russia and Ukraine, they are really, really advanced peoples. I mean, they're wearing tailored clothing in 30,000 years ago. With the needles have been found, evidence of linen and things like this have been found from 25,000 years in the Caucasus. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people are wearing clothes almost no different to what, you know, I say you and I, obviously our stuff comes from some factory in China and is imported into our country. But let's say what the Eskimos or, you know, other indigenous cultures would wear, they're wearing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And remember, they're entering into southeast Anatolia at the time of a mini ice age. In other words, there'd been a period of warming up over a period of about 2,000 years after the end of the ice age proper, which was around 13,000 BC. There had been about 2,000 years of the climate warming, and it was actually quite beautiful, you know, and the ice sheets had receded. Then you have this cataclysm. Then the ice sheets then start re-advancing really, really quickly. You know, just like in some of these, you know, disaster movies that you see, you know, that the ice age comes on in a matter of a week or something.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's almost exactly what did occur. So what happens with the populations that live in these areas? They have to move very swiftly out, or otherwise they die. And of course, because these ice ages are mostly focused around the polar regions and those regions that are just below that, you know, these sort of the temperate, I'm probably getting that term wrong, but you know, the areas that are immediately below the polar regions.
Mm-hmm.
They come south, of course they do, because it's warmer the further south you go, and that's why these people came down from the East European plain through the Caucasus down into what we know today as eastern or southeastern Anatolia, where Göbekli Tepe is. They came from the north, these people, they arrived, they were strange looking people. You know, you've got to think of these dudes. I mean, you know, they would probably have been wearing hoods, they would have been wearing tailored clothing, they had extremely long faces, these big elongated heads, which is something we've inherited, or they inherited from the Neanderthals, that had like these buns on the top of their, the back of their skulls,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was so pronounced that they almost looked like these cone heads that, you know, you see in connection with Peru and Mexico and whatever.
Okay.
And so they come into the midst of the local population. The local population don't know how to handle these people. You know, there would have been battles, there'd have been skirmishes, but eventually they'd have taken control. And how did they do this? Through cunning, through guile, through expertise and intelligence. They were trading in things like exotic minerals, like obsidian, the volcanic glass that comes from volcanoes, a very beautiful and much prized item, and other types of beautiful looking flint. And they would have gained the trust of local communities to a degree that they could start exerting their influence over them as astronomers, predicting things like comets. You know, mm-hmm. to be honest, almost certainly they would have known when what's known as short period comets would be returning. So they could have said to the local population, look, if you don't believe us, we can tell you that next year there's going to be a bigger comet appearing in your skies, you know,
yeah.
on cue. And why would they have known that? Not because they were in touch necessarily with the supernatural creatures responsible for the appearance of these, the tales of these creatures, which is how folklore and legends sees the appearance of comets in many different cultures around the world,
right.
from China to Mexico to Europe. But because they were clever, because they knew that certain comets were on short periods, possibly like Halley's Comet, has a short period orbit into the inner solar system of maybe, I can't remember what it is now, 60 or 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have known that. They would have known when certain comets returned, and they could have used that to their advantage.
Okay.
And I think that this is one of the ways that they gained control and the trust of the local people. You know, they almost appeared like messiahs, these people, because what they said was, look, trust us and we can change everything. We know what's happened and we can predict to you that no further cataclysms will occur because we're here now, and if you do what we say, it'll all go away. And that's exactly what happened over a period of 1500 years at Göbekli Tepe. And during that period, the enclosures start getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So they go from being, you know, 45 feet, 50 feet in diameter, you know, 15 meters, down to little rooms that are no bigger than a family-sized bathroom,
mm-hmm.
and with little stones about 4 or 5 feet tall. And you think, why are they creating small things like this now? It's because the impetus has gone. There was no further cataclysms, and by the end of it, they'd lost interest. And around 8000 BC, everything started to disperse. They were now more interested in the sun and the way that that could ripen their crops, because the Neolithic Revolution had kicked in.
Right.
It was now a time of agriculture. The only thing they're really interested in now is that the wheat, the rye, the barley ripens each year. So they start worshipping the sun
mm-hmm.
for the first time. Previous to this, the main celestial bodies that are important to them are the stars, and before that, the moon, which was obviously a very important female symbol.
Yeah.
With, you know, the female inner mysteries and things like this. And so things have changed. Now you've got sun worship. This is the beginning of the end, because ultimately this is going to lead to, you know, religions and monotheism and all the problems we have today.
Let me ask you a really interesting question that I found and reading Robert Schock's book, Forgotten Civilization. He claims, and you just mentioned it, that at 8,000 years ago, they filled in Göbekli, the civic centers of Göbekli Tepe. Now, and that's what you're talking about, is that they got bored, they got tired of it,
That's my opinion. I mean, you know, obviously Robert and I, we're friends, we know each other, we're often together at conferences. I mean, we have slight differences of opinion. And I'm not saying that he's wrong and I'm right or whatever, but I mean, he sees the end of Göbekli Tepe as a little bit more catastrophic.
Right.
You know, he feels that they needed to cover it over very quickly at the end of its useful life. I mean, around 8000 BC, possibly because of some kind of incoming solar event to do with coronal mass ejections from the sun that were creating, like, you know, incredible lightning strikes and bad things going on in the world and melting rock and whatever. I'm not sure about that. I mean, it's a nice idea, but for me, I think that the covering over, and this is what Professor Klaus Schmidt said, the covering over of the different enclosures was far more gradual. And I think that this occurred probably over every 100 to 150 years. The astronomical alignments that were connected with stars no longer worked because of precession. A star will move across the horizon as quickly as 1 degree every 72 years. So if your monuments are aligned to a particular star, as much as early as 100 years, they're going to be out of date. I mean, they're not going to look. Now, there may have been a certain amount of leeway that you could actually have moved the stones to follow the course of the stars, but eventually this is going to fail and you're going to need to build a new monument completely, which was probably already under construction next door. And what's happened is that the very earliest monuments at Göbekli Tepe are on the bedrock, and then they've been covered up by artificial soil that's been brought from the plains below. I mean, this is incredible, because bear in mind this is on a mountain ridge, and then more monuments are built on top of that, then they're covered up, then more are built on top of that, and that's how you get this so-called tepe or hoya, artificial mounds, that you find. I mean, you get this in places like Troy in southwestern Turkey, you know, places like, Mesopotamia, Ur, you know, the city of Ur in southern Iraq. I mean, all of these are originally just these huge, great mounds of earth that an archaeologist can look at and say, humanity was there in the past, a multi-layered, you know, what they call strata of different layers of activity over a period of maybe 2,000, 3,000 years, and they can just start digging into it and find these different layers. They didn't create that mound at the end of Göbekli Tepe's useful life. It was gradually being built over a period of 1500 years. They may have left some of the more important enclosures exposed for, you know, maybe they were more important than others, maybe they left that, but there's no question that the more time went by, the smaller and less complex, more simple the monuments they created. It's like they were losing interest. Okay. It's the same as pyramid building in Egypt. The oldest pyramids in Egypt are the most sophisticated. Take, you know, the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, the Great Pyramid, the other monuments around, you know, Cairo. They're the best, and they're the oldest.
Yeah.
After that, they started building them with mud brick and just putting, you know, facing blocks over the top of it, and of course they collapsed very quickly. And all you've got now is just a big pile of mud, you know, with some inner chamber. They didn't survive the test of time. Why didn't they evolve their pyramid style? Because they didn't need to. They got bored. I mean, you know, there is an apathy and laziness in humanity, which I think has probably been in there with us all the way along. That, you know, we're inspired to do things initially and we'll create stuff. You know, like a hotel. It's like a hotel. You know, if you go into a new hotel, everything's great, isn't it? You know, you go in, all the bedrooms are fine and the rest of it. Give it 5 years and it really starts going down the pan. It was the same thing at Göbekli Tepe, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. So in the time we have left, which is just a few minutes, I want you to give us your opinion of Göbekli Tepe from a historical perspective. And what that I'm referring to is anthropologists, historians, archaeologists haven't really moved on this new data to the effect of changing our historical reference in books, in texts, in academic reviews. It's very slow right now what this does, and this is a game changer as far as I'm concerned. Göbekli Tepe is a game changer. And so I want you to, if you, from your point of view, your perspective, what you think is the eventual outcome of this discovery?
Well, civilization is the simple answer, because it changed everything. Because remember that when the first and the greatest monuments at Göbekli Tepe were constructed, we were hunter-gatherers. There was nothing else. I mean, people say to me, well, hunter-gatherers couldn't build this. Well, there was nobody else around to do it. It had to be. And hunter-gatherers are no different to you or I. They just have a different lifestyle, you know, but they were brought together for a reason. But the thing is that a prehistorian by the name of V. Gordon Child in the 1930s and 40s created the concept of the Neolithic Revolution that ended with civilization. And what he said was that first you had agriculture, you know, because of the changing climate. That gave us more time to sit down and ponder upon the mysteries of life. We start creating temples. They need an infrastructure. The first towns, the first cities are built. That is how civilization began. We now know through the discovery of Göbekli Tepe that is absolutely wrong, and that the temples came first. They needed an infrastructure around those, and we needed to feed all the people involved in that infrastructure. That meant changes in the way that we lived, and that involved the creation of agriculture and animal husbandry, you know, the herding of animals, the keeping of animals in pens. And that is how the Neolithic Revolution began. In other words, it's been put on its head by the discovery of Göbekli Tepe.
Okay.
So in other words, the creation of Göbekli Tepe changed everything, everything. And it was that caused civilization today. If you want to point at one thing in the world and said that's responsible for everything that's happening today, it's Göbekli Tepe.
Interesting. So do you think that it will be that they'll start referring to Göbekli Tepe more in the textbooks, or is it one of those slow builds where the timelines for humanity will change as more academics begin to take in the significance of Göbekli Tepe?
Well, Klaus Schmidt himself, God rest his soul, linked not only the Anunnaki with Göbekli Tepe. He suggested that the stones actually represented the Anunnaki. He saw the Duku Mound, D-U-K-U, that the place of the birth of the Anunnaki of Göbekli Tepe. He also linked the builders of Göbekli Tepe, the elite, with what he called the Watchmen of the period, which is, I'm sure, a reference to the Watchers of the Book of Enoch. He linked it with Enoch. What a forward-thinking man. Now, okay, I said all of this about the same culture in the book from the Ashes of Angels back in 1996. But what a forward-thinking man to say this. And he's changing our perception of the impact of places like Göbekli Tepe. And that's really, really important. In other words, a lot of what people like myself and Robert Schock, Robert Bouval, Graham Hancock have been saying for many years, and people are now coming up and saying, you actually got it right. And I think that's the changing point.
Interesting.
In other words, a lot of what was seen as New Age speculation in the past is now becoming the mainstream thought of the general public, and that can only mean that eventually it's reflected in academic publications.
Okay, that's good. I appreciate that. So the book is Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods. My guest today has been Andrew Collins. Colin, Andrew, tell us, if you would, where you're going to be. Is there any conference or events that are coming up for you in the United States in the next, this coming month? I know that on your website you list, you're very active.
Okay. So. Right. Well, look, here's the score. AndrewCollins.com, www.AndrewCollins.com,
okay,
has a full listing of where I'll be. But in the States, I'm at the Paradigm Conference talking about this very subject on October 4th, 5th, with Eric Von Daniken and various other speakers, Graham Hancock. And then the following weekend, I'm in Virginia Beach for the ARE, Ecatesis ARE, Ancient Mysteries Conference, again with Eric Von Daniken, talking again about similar subjects. And that's October, a week later, the 12th, 13th, I think. So, yeah, you know, there's two places there that you can catch us. Tickets are still available. All of the websites and the links are on at www.andrewcollins.com. And if you're interested in this subject, you know, talk to me. You know, email me. Or if you just want to read the book, click through now to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and buy the book. It's cheap and it's a good read.
It is a good read. It really is. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, and we'll look forward to your future discoveries, Andrew. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
So that was Andrew Collins, and his book has been out now for a couple of months. It's called Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, The Temple of the Watchers, and the Discovery of Eden, and it's published by Bear & Company. I will be posting a number of photographs that he has sent me that are from recent visits with Professor Klaus Schmidt, and he also has some very unusual photos of the what is called the Lion Pillar Building, which is much, much more sophisticated than the central, what's called the Civic Center. So take a look at those photos, and they'll be on, they'll be posted today, which is Saturday the 6th, on the Facebook page. Go to Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. Very good. Have a great day, and look for you next week for another episode, another program of Earth Ancients. Have a great day.